rancour. Angels had certain moral standards to maintain, and so, unlike Crowley, he preferred to buy his clothes rather than wish them into being from raw firmament. And the shirt had been quite expensive. "I mean, just look at it," he said. "I'll never get the stain out."
"Miracle it away," said Crowley, scanning the undergrowth for any more management trainees.
"Yes, but I'll always know the stain was there. You know, deep down, I mean," said the angel. He picked up the gun and turned it over in his hands. "I've never seen one of these before," he said.
There was a pinging noise, and the statue beside him lost an ear.
"Let's not hang around," said Crowley. He wasn't alone. "This is a very odd gun, you know. Very strange."
"I thought your side disapproved of guns," said Crowley.
He took the gun from the angel's plump hand and sighted along the stubby barrel.
"Current thinking favours them," said Aziraphale. "They lend weight to moral argument, in the right hands, of course."
"Yeah?" Crowley snaked a hand over the metal. "Well, that's all right, then. Come on."
He dropped the gun onto the recumbent form of Tompkins and marched away across the damp lawn. The front door of the manor was unlocked. The pair of them walked through unheeded. Some plump young men, in army fatigues spattered with paint, were drinking cocoa out of mugs in what had once been the sisters' refectory, and one or two of them gave them a cheery wave. Something like a hotel reception desk now occupied one end of the hall. It had a quietly competent look. Aziraphale gazed at the board on an aluminium easel beside it. In little plastic letters let into the black fabric of the board were the words, "August 2021, United Holdings Holdings, PLC Initiative Combat Course." Meanwhile, Crowley had picked up a pamphlet from the desk. It showed glossy pictures of the manor, with special references to its jacuzzis and indoor heated swimming pool. And on the back was the sort of map that conference centres always have, which makes use of a careful misscaling to suggest that it is handy for every motorway exit in the nation, while carefully leaving out the labyrinth of country lanes that in fact surrounds it for miles on every side.
"Wrong place," said Aziraphale.
"Nope."
"Wrong time, then?"
"Yes."
Crowley leafed through the booklet in the hope of any clue. Perhaps it was too much to hope that the chattering order would still be here. After all, they'd done their bit. He hissed softly. Probably they'd gone to Darkest America or somewhere to convert the Christians. But he read on anyway. Sometimes this sort of leaflet had a little historical bit, because the kind of companies that hired places like this for a weekend of interactive personnel analysis, or a conference on the strategic marketing dynamic, liked to feel that they were strategically interacting in the very building, give or take a couple of complete rebuildings, a civil war, and two major fires, that some Elizabethan financier had endowed as a plague hospital. Not that he was actually expecting a sentence like, "Until 11 years ago, the manor was used as a convent by an order of satanic nuns, who weren't in fact all that good at it, really. But you never knew." A plump man wearing desert camouflage and holding a polystyrene cup of coffee wandered up to them.
"Who's winning?" he said chummily. "Young Evanson of Forward Planning caught me a right zinger on the elbow, you know."
"We're all going to lose," said Crowley absently.
There was a burst of firing from the grounds. Not the snap and zing of pellets, but the full-throated crackle of aerodynamically shaped bits of lead travelling extremely fast. There was an answering stutter. The redundant warriors stared one on another. A further burst took out a rather ugly Victorian stained glass window beside the door and stitched a row of holes in the plaster by Crowley's head. Aziraphale grabbed his arm.
"What the hell is it?" he said.
Crowley smiled like a snake. Nigel Tompkins had come to with a mild headache and a vaguely empty space in his recent memory.
He was not to know that the human brain, when faced with a sight too terrible to contemplate, is remarkably good at scabbing it over with forced forgetfulness. So he put it down to a pellet strike on the head. He was vaguely aware that his gun was somewhat heavier, but in his mildly bemused state, he did not realize why until some time after he'd pointed it at trainee manager Norman Weathered from internal audit and pulled the trigger.
"I don't see why you're so shocked," said Crowley. "He wanted a real gun. Every desire in his head was for a real gun. But you've turned him loose on all those unprotected people," said Aziraphale.
"Oh, no," said Crowley. "Not exactly. Fair is fair."
The contingent from financial planning were lying flat on their faces in what had once been the ha-ha, although they weren't very amused.
"I always said you couldn't trust those people from purchasing," said the deputy financial manager. "The bastards!"
A shot pinged off the wall above him. He crawled hurriedly over to the little group clustered around the fallen Weathered.
"How does it look?" he said.
The assistant head of wages turned a haggard face toward him.
"Pretty bad," he said. "The bullet went through nearly all of them. Access, Barclay Card, Diners, the lot."
"It was only the American Express gold that stopped it," said Weathered.
They looked in mute horror at the spectacle of a credit card wallet with a bullet hole nearly all the way through it.
"Why did they do it?" said a wages officer.
The head of internal audit opened his mouth to say something reasonable, and didn't. Everyone had a point where they crack, and his had just been hit with a spoon. 20 years in the job. He'd wanted to be a graphic designer, but the careers master hadn't heard of that. 20 years of double-checking form BF18. 20 years of cranking the bloody hand calculator, when even the people in forward planning had computers. And now, for reasons unknown, but possibly to do with reorganization and a desire to do away with all the expense of early retirement, they were shooting at him with bullets. The armies of paranoia marched behind his eyes. He looked down at his own gun. Through the mists of rage and bewilderment, he saw that it was bigger and blacker than it had been when it was issued to him. It felt heavier, too. He aimed it at a bush nearby and watched a stream of bullets blow the bush into oblivion.
Oh, so that was their game. Well, someone had to win.
He looked at his men.
"Okay, guys," he said. "Let's get the bastards."
"The way I see it," said Crowley,
"no one has to pull the trigger."
He gave Aziraphale a bright and brittle grin. "Come on," he said. "Let's have a look around while everyone's busy." Bullets streaked across the night. Jonathan Parker, purchasing section, was wriggling through the bushes when one of them put an arm around his neck. Nigel Tompkins spat a cluster of rhododendron leaves out of his mouth.
"Down there, it's company law,"
he hissed through mud-encrusted features.
"But up here, it's me."
"That was a pretty load trick," said Aziraphale as they strolled along the empty corridors.
"What'd I do? What'd I do?"
said Crowley, pushing open doors at random.
"There are people out there shooting one another."
"Well, that's just it, isn't it? They're doing it themselves.
It's what they really want to do. I just assisted them. Think of it as a microcosm of the universe. Free will for everyone. Ineffable, right?"
Aziraphale glared.
"Oh, all right," said Crowley wretchedly. "No one's actually going to get killed. They're all going to have miraculous escapes. It wouldn't be any fun otherwise."
Aziraphale relaxed.
"You know, Crowley," he said, beaming, "I've always said that deep down inside, you're really quite up..."
"Yeah, all right, all right," Crowley snapped.
"Tell the whole blessed world, why don't you?"
After a while, loose alliances began to emerge. Most of the financial departments found they had interests in common, settled their differences, and ganged up on forward planning.
When the first police car arrived, 16 bullets from a variety of directions had hit it in the radiator before it had got halfway up the drive. Two more took out its radio antenna, but they were too late, too late. Mary Hodges was just putting down the phone when Crowley opened her office door.
"It must be terrorists," she snapped, "or poachers."
She peered at the pair of them.
"You are the police, aren't you?" she said.
Crowley saw her eyes begin to widen. Like all demons, he had a good memory for faces, even after 11 years, the loss of a wimple, and the addition of some rather severe makeup. He snapped his fingers. She settled back in her chair, her face becoming a blank and amiable mask.
"There was no need for that," said Aziraphale.
"Good," Crowley glanced at his watch.
"Morning, ma'am," he said in a sing-song voice. "We're just a couple of supernatural entities, and we were just wondering if you might help us with the whereabouts of the notorious son of Satan."
He smiled coldly at the angel.
"I'll wake her up again, shall I? And you can say it."
"Well, since you put it like that," said the angel slowly.
"Sometimes the old ways are best," said Crowley.
He turned to the impassive woman.
"Were you a nun here 11 years ago?" he said.
"Yes," said Mary.
"There," said Crowley to Aziraphale. "See? I knew I wasn't wrong."
"Luck of the devil," muttered the angel.
"Your name then was Sister Talkative, or something?"
"Loquacious,"
said Mary Hodges in a hollow voice.
"And do you recall an incident involving the switching of newborn babies?" said Crowley.
Mary Hodges hesitated. When she did speak, it was as though memories that had been scabbed over were being disturbed for the first time in years.
"Yeah,"
she said. "Is there any possibility that the switch could have gone wrong in some way?"
"I do not know."
Crowley thought for a bit.
"You must have had records," he said. "There are always records. Everyone has records these days."
He glanced proudly at Aziraphale.
"It was one of my better ideas."
"Oh, yes,"
said Mary Hodges.
"And where are they?" said Aziraphale, sweetly.
"There was a fire, just after the birth."
Crowley groaned and threw his hands in the air.
"Ah, that was Hastur, probably," he said. "It's his style. Can you believe those guys? I bet he thought he was being really clever."
"Do you recall any details about the other child?" said Aziraphale.
"Yes."
"Please tell me."
"He had lovely little toesy-woesies."
"No."
"And he was very sweet,"
said Mary Hodges wistfully. There was the sound of a siren outside, abruptly broken off as a bullet hit it. Aziraphale nudged Crowley.
"Get a move on," he said. "We're going to be knee-deep in police at any moment, and I will, of course, be morally obliged to assist them in their inquiries."
He thought for a moment.
"Perhaps she can remember if there were any other women giving birth that night, and..."
There was the sound of running feet downstairs.
"Stop them," said Crowley. "We need more time." "Any more miracles and we'll really start getting noticed by up there," said Aziraphale. "If you really want Gabriel or someone wondering why 40 policemen have gone to sleep..."
"Okay," said Crowley. "That's it. That's it. It was worth a try. Let's get out of here."
"In 30 seconds you will wake up," said Aziraphale to the entranced ex-nun. "And you will have had a lovely dream about whatever you like best." "And yes, yes, fine," sighed Crowley. "Now, can we go?"
No one noticed them leaving. The police were too busy herding in 40 adrenaline-drunk, fighting-mad management trainees. 3 police vans had gouged tracks in the lawn, and Aziraphale made Crowley back up for the first of the ambulances. But then the Bentley swished into the night. Behind them, the summer house and gazebo were already ablaze.
"We've really left that poor woman in a dreadful situation," said the angel.
"You think?" said Crowley, trying to hit a hedgehog and missing. "Bookings will double, you mark my words.
If she plays her cards right, sorts out the waivers, ties up all the legal bits.
Initiative training with real guns? They'll form queues.
Why are you always so cynical?
Well, I said, because it's my job.
They drove in silence for a while. Then Aziraphale said,
You'd think he'd show up, wouldn't you? You'd think we could detect him in some way.
He won't show up.
Not to us. Protective camouflage. He won't even know it, but his powers will keep him hidden from prying occult forces.
Occult forces?
You and me, explained Crowley.
I'm not occult, said Aziraphale.
Angels aren't occult. We're ethereal.
Ah, whatever, snapped Crowley, too worried to argue.
Is there some other way of locating him?
Crowley shrugged. Search me, he said.
How much experience do you think I've got in these matters? Armageddon only happens once, you know. They don't let you go around again until you get it right.
The angel stared out at the rushing hedgerows.
It all seems so peaceful, he said. How do you think it will happen?
Well, thermonuclear extinction has always been very popular. Although, I must say, the big boys are being quite polite to each other at the moment.
Asteroid strike, said Aziraphale.
Quite the fashion these days, I understand. Strike into the Indian Ocean, great big cloud of dust and vapour. Goodbye, all higher life forms.
Wow, said Crowley, taking care to exceed the speed limit. Every little bit helped.
Doesn't bear thinking about, does it? Said Aziraphale gloomily.
All the higher life forms scythed away, just like that.
Terrible. Nothing but dust and fundamentalists.
That was nasty.
Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
They stared at the road.
Maybe some terrorist, Aziraphale began.
Not one of ours, said Crowley.
Or ours, said Aziraphale. Although ours are freedom fighters, of course.
I'll tell you what, said Crowley, scorching rubber on the Tadfield bypass. Cards on the table time.
I'll tell you ours, if you tell me yours.
All right.
You first.
Oh, no, you first.
But you're a demon.
Yeah, but a demon of my word, I should hope.
Aziraphale named five political leaders. Crowley named six. Three names appeared on both lists.
See? Said Crowley. It's just like I've always said, they're cunning buggers, humans. You can't trust them an inch.
But I don't think any of ours have any big plans afoot, said Aziraphale.
Just minor acts of terror... political protest, he corrected.
Ah, said Crowley, bitterly. You mean none of this cheap mass-produced murder?
Just personal service, every bullet individually fired by skilled craftsmen.
Aziraphale didn't rise to it.
What are we going to do now?
Try and get some sleep.
You don't need sleep. I don't need sleep. Evil never sleeps, and virtue is ever vigilant.
Well, evil in general, maybe. This specific part of it has got into the habit of getting its head down occasionally.
He stared into the headlights.
The time would come soon enough when sleep would be right out of the question. When those below found out that he, personally, had lost the Antichrist, they'd probably dig out all those reports he'd done on the Spanish Inquisition and try them out on him, one at a time, and then all together.
He rummaged in the glove compartment, fumbled a tape at random, and slotted it into the player. A little music would...
Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me, for me,
for me, murmured Crowley.
His expression went blank for a moment. Then he gave a strangled scream and wrenched at the on-off knob.
Of course, we might be able to get a human to find him, said Aziraphale thoughtfully.
What? Said Crowley, distractedly.
Humans are good at finding other humans. They've been doing it for thousands of years. And the child is human, as well as, you know. He would be hidden from us, but other humans might be able to, sense him, perhaps. Or spot things we wouldn't think of.
Ah, it wouldn't work.
He's the Antichrist. He's got this, sort of automatic defense, hasn't he? Even if he doesn't know it.
It won't even let people suspect him. Well, not yet. Not till it's ready. Suspicion will slide off him like, well, whatever it is water slides off of, he finished lamely.
Got any better ideas? Got one single better idea? Said Aziraphale.
No.
Right, then. It could work. Don't tell me you haven't got any front organizations you could use. I know I have. We could see if they can pick up the trail.
Well, what could they do that we couldn't do?
Well, for a start, they wouldn't get people to shoot one another. They wouldn't hypnotize respectable women. Okay.
But it hasn't got a snowball's chance in hell. Well, believe me, I know. But I can't think of anything better. Crowley turned onto the motorway and headed for London.
I have a certain network of agents, said Aziraphale after a while, spread across the country, a disciplined force. I could set them searching.
I have something similar, Crowley admitted. You know how it is, you never know when they might come in handy.
We'd better alert them. Do you think they ought to work together?
Crowley shook his head. I don't think that would be a good idea, he said. They're not very sophisticated, politically speaking.
Then we'll each contact our own people and see what they can manage.
Got to be worth a try, I suppose, said Crowley. It's not as if I haven't got lots of other work to do, God knows. His forehead creased for a moment, and then he slapped the steering wheel triumphantly.
Ducks! He shouted.
What?
Oh, that's what water slides off.
Aziraphale took a deep breath. Just drive the car, please, he said wearily. They drove back through the dawn while the cassette player played J.S. Bach's Mass in B minor, vocals by F. Mercury. Crowley liked the city in the early morning. Its population consisted almost entirely of people who had proper jobs to do and real reasons for being there, as opposed to the unnecessary millions who trailed in after 8 a.m., and the streets were more or less quiet. There were double yellow no-parking lines in the narrow road outside Aziraphale's bookshop, but they obediently rolled back on themselves when the Bentley pulled in to the curb.
"Well, okay," he said, as Aziraphale got his coat from the back seat. "We'll keep in touch, okay?"
"What's this?" said Aziraphale, holding up a brown oblong. Crowley squinted at it.
"A book?" he said.
"No, not mine." Aziraphale turned a few of the yellowed pages. Tiny bibliophilic bells rang in the back of his mind.
"It must have belonged to that young lady," he said slowly. "We ought to have got her address."
"Look, I'm in enough trouble as it is. I don't want it to get about that I go around returning people's property to them," said Crowley. Aziraphale reached the title page. It was probably a good job Crowley couldn't see his expression.
"Well, I suppose you could always send it to the post office there," said Crowley, "if you really feel you must. Address it to the mad woman with the bicycle.
Never trust a woman who gives funny names to means of transport."
Yes, certainly, said the angel.
He fumbled for his keys, dropped them on the pavement, picked them up, dropped them again, and hurried to the shop door.
"We'll be in touch then, shall we?"
Crowley called after him. Aziraphale paused in the act of turning the key.
"What?"
he said.
Oh, yes, fine. Jolly good."
And he slammed the door.
"Right," mumbled Crowley,
suddenly feeling very alone. Torchlight flicked in the lanes. The trouble with trying to find a brown-covered book among brown leaves and brown water at the bottom of a ditch of brown earth in the brown, well, greyish light of dawn was that you couldn't. It wasn't there. Anathema tried every method of search she could think of. There was the methodical quartering of the ground. There was the slapdash poking at the bracken by the roadside. There was the nonchalant sidling up to it and looking out of the side of her eye. She even tried the one which every romantic nerve in her body insisted should work, which consisted of theatrically giving up
sitting down and letting her glance fall naturally on a patch of earth, which, if she had been in any decent narrative, should have contained the bog. It didn't. Which meant, as she had feared all along, that it was probably in the back of a car belonging to two consenting cycle repairmen. She could feel generations of Agnes Nutter's descendants laughing at her. Even if those two were honest enough to want to return it, they'd hardly go to all the trouble of finding a cottage they'd barely seen in the dark. The only hope was that they wouldn't know what it was they'd got. Aziraphale, like many Soho merchants who specialized in hard-to-find books for the discerning connoisseur, had a back room. But what was in there was far more esoteric than anything normally found inside a shrink-wrapped bag for the customer who knows what he wants. He was particularly proud of his books of prophecy, first editions usually, and every one was signed. He'd got Robert Nixon. Footnote, a 16th-century half-wit, not related to any U.S. president, and Martha the Gypsy, and Ignatius Sibylla, and old Otwell Binns. Nostradamus had signed, "To mine old friend Aziraphale, with best wishes." Mother Shipton had spilled drink on his copy, and in a climate-controlled cabinet in one corner was the original scroll in the shaky handwriting of St. John the Divine of Patmos, whose revelation had been the all-time bestseller. Aziraphale had found him a nice chap, if a bit too fond of odd mushrooms. What the collection did not have was a copy of The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, and Aziraphale walked into the room holding it as a keen philatelist might hold a Mauritius blue that had just turned up on a postcard from his aunt. He'd never even seen a copy before, but he'd heard about it. Everyone in the trade, which, considering it was a highly specialized trade, meant about a dozen people, had heard of it. Its existence was a sort of vacuum around which all sorts of strange stories had been orbiting for hundreds of years. Aziraphale realized he wasn't sure if you could orbit a vacuum, and didn't care. The Nice and Accurate Prophecies made the Hitler Diaries look like, well, a bunch of forgeries. His hands hardly shook at all as he laid it down on a bench, pulled on a pair of surgical rubber gloves, and opened it reverentially. Aziraphale was an angel, but he also worshipped books. The title page said, "The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter." In slightly smaller type, "Being a certain and precise history from the present day unto the endinger of this world." In slightly larger type, "Containing therein many diverse wonders and precepts for the wise." In a different type, "More complete than ever yet before published." In smaller type, but in capitals, "Concerning the strange times ahead." In slightly desperate italics, "And events of a wonderful nature." In larger type once more, "Reminiscent of Nostradamus at his best, Ursula Shipton." The prophecies were numbered, and there were more than 4,000 of them. "Steady, steady," Aziraphale muttered to himself. He went into the little kitchenette and made himself some cocoa and took some deep breaths. Then he came back and read a prophecy at random. 40 minutes later, the cocoa was still untouched. The red-haired woman in the corner of the hotel bar was the most successful war correspondent in the world. She now had a passport in the name of Carmine Zwiegeber, and she went where the wars were. Well, more or less. Actually, she went where the wars weren't. She'd already been where the wars were. She was not well known, except where it counted. Get half a dozen war correspondents together in an airport bar, and the conversation will, like a compass orienting to north, swing around to Murchison of the New York Times, to Van Horn of Newsweek, to Anforth of ITN News. The war correspondents, war correspondents. But when Murchison and Van Horn and Anforth ran into each other in a burnt-out tin shack in Beirut, or Afghanistan, or the Sudan, after they'd admired each other's scars and had downed a few, they would exchange awed anecdotes of Red Zwieger from the National World Weekly. "That dumb rag," Murchison would say, "it doesn't goddamn know what it's goddamn got." Actually, the National World Weekly did know just what it had got. It had a war correspondent. It just didn't know why or what to do with one. Now it had her. A typical National World Weekly would tell the world how Jesus' face was seen on a Big Mac bun bought by someone from Des Moines, with an artist's impression of the bun. How Elvis Presley was recently sighted working in a burger lord in Des Moines. How listening to Elvis records cured a Des Moines housewife's cancer. How the spate of werewolves infesting the Midwest are the offspring of noble pioneer women raped by Bigfoot. And that Elvis was taken by space aliens in 1976 because he was too good for this world. Footnote. Remarkably, one of these stories is indeed true. That was the National World Weekly. They sold 4 million copies a week, and they needed a war correspondent like they needed an exclusive interview with the General Secretary of the United Nations. Footnote. The interview was done in 1983, and went as follows.
Question. You're the Secretary of the United Nations, then?
Answer.
Si.
Question. Ever cited Elvis?
So they paid Red Zwieger a great deal of money to go and find wars, and ignored the bulging, badly typed envelopes she sent them occasionally from around the globe to justify her generally fairly reasonable expense claims. They felt justified in this because, as they saw it, she really wasn't a very good war correspondent, although she was undoubtedly the most attractive, which counted for a lot on the National World Weekly. Her war reports were always about a bunch of guys shooting at each other with no real understanding of the wider political ramifications and, more importantly, no human interest. Occasionally they would hand one of her stories over to a rewrite man to fix up. Jesus appeared to 9-year-old Manuel Gonzalez during a pitched battle on the Rio Concorsa and told him to go home because his mother worried about him. "I knew it was Jesus," said the brave little child, "because he looked like he did when his picture miraculously appeared on my sandwich box." Mostly, the National World Weekly left her alone and carefully filed her stories in the rubbish bin. Murchison and Van Horn and Anforth didn't care about this. All they knew was that whenever a war broke out, Ms. Zwieger was there first, practically before. "How does she do it?" they would ask each other incredulously. "How the hell does she do it?" And their eyes would meet and silently say, "If she was a car, she'd be made by Ferrari. She's the kind of woman you'd expect to see as the beautiful consort to the corrupt generalissimo of a collapsing third-world country. And she hangs around with guys like us. We're the lucky guys, right?" Ms. Zwieger just smiled and bought another round of drinks for everybody on the National World Weekly and watched the fights break out around her and smiled. She had been right. Journalism suited her. Even so, everyone needs a holiday, and Red Zwieger was on her first in 11 years. She was on a small Mediterranean island, which made its money from the tourist trade, and that in itself was odd. Red looked to be the kind of woman who, if she took a holiday on any island smaller than Australia, would be doing so because she was friends with the man who owned it. And had you told any islander a month before that war was coming, he would have laughed at you and tried to sell you a raffia work wine holder, or a picture of the bay done in seashells. That was then. This was now. Now, a deep religio-political divide concerning which of four small mainland countries they weren't actually a part of had split the country into three factions, destroyed the statue of Santa Maria in the town square, and done for the tourist trade. Red Zwieger sat in the bar of the Hotel de Palomar del Sol, drinking what passed for a cocktail. In one corner, a tired pianist played, and a waiter in a toupee crooned into a microphone,
"Once upon a time there was little white bull, a very sad because he was little white bull."
A man threw himself through the window, a knife between his teeth, a Kalashnikov automatic rifle in one hand, a grenade in the other.
"I claim this hotel in the gang of the..."
He paused. He took the knife out of his mouth and began again.
"I claim this hotel in the name of the pro-Turkish liberation faction."
The last two holidaymakers remaining on the island climbed underneath their table. Footnote. Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Threlfall of 9 The Elms, Paignton. They always maintained that one of the nice things about going on holiday was not having to read the newspapers or listen to the news, just getting away from it all, really. And due to a tummy bug contracted by Mr. Threlfall and Mrs. Threlfall rather overdoing it in the sun their first day, this was their first time out of their hotel room for a week and a half. Red unconcernedly withdrew the maraschino cherry from her drink, put it to her scarlet lips, and sucked it slowly off its stick in a way that made several men in the room break into a cold sweat. The pianist stood up, reached into his piano, and pulled out a vintage submachine gun.
"This hotel has already been claimed by the pro-Greek territorial brigade," he screamed. "Make one false move and I shoot out your living daylight."
There was a motion at the door. A huge black-bearded individual with a golden smile and a genuine antique Gatling gun stood there, with a cohort of equally huge, although less impressively armed, men behind him.
"This strategically important hotel, for years a symbol of the fascist, imperialist, Turco-Greek, running-dog tourist trade, is now the property of the Italo-Maltese freedom fighters,"
he boomed affably.
"Now we kill everybody."
"Rubbish," said the pianist. "Is not strategically important, just has extremely well-stocked wine cellar."
"He is right, Pedro," said the man with the Kalashnikov. "That's why my lot wanted it. Il General Ernesto de Montoya said to me, he said, 'Fernando, the war will be over by Saturday, and the lads will be wanting a good time. Pop down to the Hotel de Paloma del Sol and claim it as booty, will you?'"
The bearded man turned red.
"Is bloody important strategically, Fernando Chianti. I drew big map of the island and is right in the middle, which makes it pretty bloody strategically important, I can tell you."
"Ha," said Fernando. "You might as well say that just because little Diego's house has a view of the decadent capitalist topless private beach, that it is strategically important."
The pianist blushed a deep red.
"Our lot got that this morning," he admitted.
There was silence. In the silence was a faint, silken rasping. Red had uncrossed her legs. The pianist's Adam's apple bobbed up and down.
"Well, it's pretty strategically important," he managed, trying to ignore the woman on the barstool. "I mean, if someone landed a submarine on it, you'd want to be somewhere you could see it all."
Silence.
"Well, it's a lot more strategically important than this hotel, anyway," he finished.
Pedro coughed ominously.
"The next person who says anything, anything at all, is dead."
He grinned, hefted his gun.
"Right. Now, everyone against Farwall."
Nobody moved. They weren't listening to him anymore. They were listening to a low, indistinct murmuring from the hallway behind him, quiet and monotonous. There was some shuffling among the cohort in the doorway.
They seemed to be doing their best to stand firm, but they were being inexorably edged out of the way by the muttering, which had begun to resolve itself into audible phrases.
"Don't mind me, gents. What a night, eh? Three times round the island, nearly didn't find the place. Someone doesn't believe in signposts, eh? Still, found it in the end, had to stop and ask four times. Finally asked at the post office. They always know at the post office. Had to draw me a map, though. Got it here somewhere."
Sliding serenely past the men with guns, like a pike through a trout pond, came a small, bespectacled man in a blue uniform, carrying a long, thin, brown paper-wrapped parcel tied with string. His sole concession to the climate were his open-toed brown plastic sandals, although the green woolen socks he wore underneath them showed his deep and natural distrust of foreign weather. He had a peaked cap on with International Express written on it in large white letters. He was unarmed, but no one touched him. No one even pointed a gun at him. They just stared. The little man looked around the room, scanning the faces, and then looking back down at his clipboard. Then he walked straight over to Red, still sitting on her bar stool.
"Package for you, miss," he said.
Red took it and began to untie the string. The International Express man coughed discreetly and presented the journalist with a well-thumbed receipt pad and a yellow plastic ballpoint pen attached to the clipboard by a piece of string.
"You have to sign for it, miss. Just there. Print your full name over here, signature down there."
"Of course." Red signed the receipt pad, illegibly, then printed her name. The name she wrote was not Carmine Zwieger. It was a much shorter name. The man thanked her kindly and made his way out, muttering,
"Lovely place you've got here, gents. Always meant to come out here on holiday. Sorry to trouble you. Oh, excuse me, sir."
And he passed out of their lives as serenely as he had come. Red finished opening the parcel. People began to edge around to get a better look. Inside the package was a large sword. She examined it. It was a very straightforward sword, long and sharp. It looked both old and unused, and it had nothing ornamental or impressive about it. This was no magical sword, no mystic weapon of power and might. It was very obviously a sword created to slice, chop, cut, preferably kill, but failing that, irreparably maim a very large number of people indeed. It had an indefinable aura of hatred and menace. Red clasped the hilt in her exquisitely manicured right hand and held it up to eye level. The blade glinted.
"All right," she said, stepping down from the stool. "Finally."
She finished the drink, hefted the sword over one shoulder, and looked around at the puzzled factions who now encircled her completely.
"Sorry to run out on you, chaps," she said. "Would love to stay and get to know you better."
The men in the room suddenly realized that they didn't want to know her better. She was beautiful, but she was beautiful in the way a forest fire was beautiful, something to be admired from a distance, not up close. And she held her sword, and she smiled like a knife. There were a number of guns in that room, and slowly, tremblingly, they were focused on her chest and her back and head. They encircled her completely.
"Don't move,"
croaked Pedro. Everybody else nodded. Red shrugged. She began to walk forward. Every finger on every trigger tightened almost of its own accord. Lead and the smell of cordite filled the air. Red's cocktail glass smashed in her hand. The room's remaining mirrors exploded in lethal shards. Part of the ceiling fell down. And then it was over. Carmine Zwieger turned and stared at the bodies surrounding her, as if she hadn't the faintest idea of how they came to be there. She licked a spatter of blood, someone else's, from the back of her hand with a scarlet, cat-like tongue. Then she smiled, and she walked out of the bar, her heels clicking on the tiles like the tapping of distant hammers. The two holidaymakers climbed out from under the table and surveyed the carnage.
"This wouldn't have happened if we'd have gone to Tormelinus like we usually do," said one of them, plaintively.
"Foreigners," sighed the other.
"They're just not like us, Patricia." "Well, that settles it, then. Next year we go to Brighton," said Mrs. Threlfall,
completely missing the significance of what had just happened. It meant there wouldn't be any next year. It rather lowered the odds on there being any next week to speak of. Thursday. There was a newcomer in the village. New people were always a source of interest and speculation among the them. Footnote. It didn't matter what the four had called their gang over the years, the frequent name changes usually being prompted by whatever Adam had happened to have read or viewed the previous day. The Adam Young Squad? Adam and Co., the Hole in the Chalk Gang? The really well-known four? The Legion of Really Superheroes? The Quarry Gang? The Secret Four? The Justice Society of Tadfield? The Galaxatrons? The Four Just Persons? The Rebels. Everyone else always referred to them darkly as them. And eventually, they did too. But this time Pepper had impressive news.
"She's moved into Jasmine Cottage, and she's a witch," she said. "I know, because Mrs. Henderson does the cleaning, and she told my mother she gets a witch's newspaper. She gets loads of ordinary newspapers too, but she gets this special witch's one." "My father says there's no such thing as witches," said Wensleydale,
who had fair wavy hair and peered seriously out at life through thick black-rimmed spectacles. It was widely believed that he had once been christened Jeremy, but no one ever used the name, not even his parents, who called him Youngster. They did this in the subconscious hope that he might take the hint. Wensleydale gave the impression of having been born with a mental age of 47.
"Don't see why not," said Brian,
who had a wide, cheerful face under an apparently permanent layer of grime.
"I don't see why witches shouldn't have their own newspaper. With stories about all the latest spells and that. My father gets Angler's Mail, and I bet there's more witches than anglers."
"It's called Psychic News," volunteered Pepper.
"That's not witches," said Wensleydale. "My aunt has that. That's just spoon-bending and fortune-telling, and people thinking they were Queen Elizabeth I in another life. There's no witches any more, actually. People invented medicines and that, and told them they didn't need them any more, and started burning them."
"It could have pictures of frogs and things," said Brian,
who was reluctant to let a good idea go to waste,
and road tests of broomsticks, and a cat's column."
"Anyway, your aunt could be a witch," said Pepper, "in secret. She could be your aunt all day and go witching at night."
"Not my aunt," said Wensleydale darkly.
"And recipes," said Brian. "New uses for leftover toad."
"Oh, shut up," said Pepper.
Brian snorted. If it had been Wensley who had said that, there'd have been a half-hearted scuffle, as between friends. But the other them had long ago learned that Pepper did not consider herself bound by the informal conventions of brotherly scuffles. She could kick and bite with astonishing physiological accuracy for a girl of 11. Besides, at 11 years old, the them were beginning to be bothered by the dim conception that laying hands on good old Pep moved things into blood-thumping categories they weren't entirely at home with yet, besides earning you a snake-fast blow that would have floored the Karate Kid. But she was good to have in your gang. They remembered with pride the time when Greasy Johnson and his gang had taunted them for playing with a girl. Pepper had erupted with a fury that had caused Greasy's mother to come round that evening and complain. Footnote. Greasy Johnson was a sad and oversized child. There's one in every school, not exactly fat, but simply huge and wearing almost the same size clothes as his father. Paper tore under his tremendous fingers, pens shattered in his grip. Children whom he tried to play with in quiet, friendly games ended up getting under his huge feet, and Greasy Johnson had become a bully almost in self-defense. After all, it was better to be called a bully, which at least implied some sort of control and desire, than to be called a big, clumsy oaf. He was the despair of the sportsmaster, because if Greasy Johnson had taken the slightest interest in sport, then the school could have been champions. But Greasy Johnson had never found a sport that suited him. He was instead secretly devoted to his collection of tropical fish, which won him prizes. Greasy Johnson was the same age as Adam Young, to within a few hours, and his parents had never told him he was adopted. See? You were right about the babies. Pepper looked upon him, a giant male, as a natural enemy. She herself had short red hair and a face which was not so much freckled as one big freckle with occasional areas of skin. Pepper's given first names were Pippin, Galadriel, Moonchild. She'd been given them in a naming ceremony in a muddy valley field that contained 3 sick sheep and a number of leaky polythene teepees. Her mother had chosen the Welsh valley of Panty Girdle as the ideal site to return to nature. 6 months later, sick of the rain, the mosquitoes, the men, the tent-trampling sheep, who ate first the whole commune's marijuana crop and then its antique minibus, and by now beginning to glimpse why almost the entire drive of human history has been an attempt to get as far away from nature as possible, Pepper's mother returned to Pepper's surprised grandparents in Tadfield, bought a bra, and enrolled in a sociology course with a deep sigh of relief. There are only 2 ways a child can go with a name like Pippin Galadriel Moonchild, and Pepper had chosen the other one. The 3 male them had learned this on their first day of school in the playground at the age of 4. They had asked her her name, and, all innocent, she had told them. Subsequently, a bucket of water had been needed to separate Pippin Galadriel Moonchild's teeth from Adam's shoe. Wensleydale's first pair of spectacles had been broken, and Brian's sweater needed 5 stitches. The them were together from then on, and Pepper was Pepper forever. Except to her mother, and when they were feeling especially courageous and the them were almost out of earshot, Greasy Johnson and the Johnsonites, the village's only other gang. Adam drummed his heels on the edge of the milk crate that was doing the office of a seat, listening to this bickering with the relaxed air of a king listening to the idle chatter of his courtiers. He chewed lazily on a straw. It was a Thursday morning. The holidays stretched ahead, endless and unsullied. They needed filling up. He let the conversation float around him like the buzzing of grasshoppers, or, more precisely, like a prospector watching the churning gravel for a glint of useful gold.
"In our Sunday paper, it said there was thousands of witches in the country," said Brian. "Worshipping nature and eating health food and that, so I don't see why we shouldn't have one round here. They were flooding the country with a wave of mindless evil, it said."
"What, by worshipping nature and eating health food?"
said Wensleydale. "Well, that's what it said."
The them gave this due consideration. They had once, at Adam's instigation, tried a health food diet for a whole afternoon. Their verdict was that you could live very well on healthy food, provided you had a big cooked lunch beforehand. Brian leaned forward conspiratorially.
"And it said they dance round with no clothes on," he added. "They go up on hills and Stonehenge and stuff, and dance with no clothes on."
This time, the consideration was more thoughtful. The them had reached that position where, as it were, the roller coaster of life had almost completed the long haul to the top of the first big humpback of puberty, so that they could just look down into the precipitous ride ahead, full of mystery, terror, and exciting curves.
"Ha!"
said Pepper.
Not my aunt, said Wensleydale, breaking the spell. Definitely not my aunt. She just keeps trying to talk to my uncle.
Your uncle's dead, said Pepper.
She says he still moves a glass about, said Wensleydale, defensively. My father says it was moving glasses about the whole time that made him dead in the first place. Don't know why she wants to talk to him, he added. They never talked much when he was alive.
That's necromancy, that is, said Brian. It's in the Bible. She ought to stop it. God's dead against necromancy. And witches. You can go to hell for it.
There was a lazy shifting of position on the milk crate throne. Adam was going to speak. The them fell silent. Adam was always worth listening to. Deep in their hearts, the them knew that they weren't a gang of four. They were a gang of three which belonged to Adam.
But if you wanted excitement and interest and crowded days, then every them would prize a lowly position in Adam's gang above leadership of any other gang anywhere.
Don't see why everyone's so down on witches, Adam said.
The them glanced at one another. This sounded promising. Well, they'd like crops, said Pepper, and sink ships, and tell you if you're going to be king and stuff, and brew up stuff with herbs.
My mother uses herbs, said Adam. So does yours.
Oh, those are all right, said Brian,
determined not to lose his position as occult expert.
I expect God said it was all right to use mint and sage and so on. Stands to reason there's nothing wrong with mint and sage. And they can make you be ill just by looking at you, said Pepper. It's called the evil eye. They give you a look, and then you get ill and no one knows why. And they make a model of you and stick it full of pins, and you get ill where all the pins are, she added cheerfully.
That sort of thing doesn't happen anymore, reiterated Wensleydale, the rational thinking person.
Because we invented science, and all the vicars set fire to the witches for their own good. It was called the Spanish Inquisition.
Then I reckon we should find out if her at Jasmine Cottage is a witch, and if she is, we should tell Mr. Pickersgill, said Brian.
Mr. Pickersgill was the vicar. Currently he was in dispute with the them over subjects ranging from climbing the yew tree in the churchyard to ringing the bells and running away.
I don't reckon it's allowed going round setting fire to people, said Adam. Otherwise people would be doing it all the time.
It's all right if you're religious, said Brian reassuringly. And it stops the witches from going to hell, so I expect they'd be quite grateful if they understood it properly.
Can't see Picky setting fire to anyone, said Pepper.
Oh, I don't know, said Brian meaningfully. Not actually setting them on an actual fire, sniffed Pepper. He's more likely to tell their parents and leave it up to them if anyone's going to be set on fire or not.
The them shook their heads in disgust at the current low standards of ecclesiastical responsibility. Then the other three looked expectantly at Adam. They always looked expectantly at Adam. He was the one that had the ideas.
"Perhaps we ought to do it ourselves," he said. "Someone ought to be doing something, if there's all these witches about. It's like that neighbourhood watch scheme."
"Neighbourhood witch," said Pepper.
"No," said Adam coldly.
"But we can't be the Spanish Inquisition," said Wensleydale. "We're not Spanish."
"I bet you don't have to be Spanish to be the Spanish Inquisition," said Adam. "I bet it's like Scottish eggs or American hamburgers. It just has to look Spanish. We've just got to make it look Spanish. Then everyone would know it's the Spanish Inquisition."
There was silence. It was broken by the crackling of one of the empty crisp packets that accumulated wherever Brian was sitting. They looked at him.
"I've got a bullfight poster with my name on it," said Brian slowly.
Lunchtime came and went. The new Spanish Inquisition reconvened. The head inquisitor inspected it critically.
"What are those?" he demanded.
"You click them together when you dance,"
said Wensleydale a shade defensively.
"My aunt brought them back from Spain years ago. They're called maracas, I think. They've got a picture of a Spanish dancer on them. Look."
"What's she dancing with a ball for?" said Adam.
Well, that's to show it's Spanish, said Wensleydale.
Adam let it pass. The bullfight poster was everything Brian had promised. Pepper had something rather like a gravy boat made out of raffia.
It's for putting wine in, she said defiantly. My mother brought it back from Spain.
It hasn't got a bull on it, said Adam severely.
It doesn't have to, Pepper countered, moving just ever so slightly into a fighting stance. Adam hesitated. His sister Sarah and her boyfriend had also been to Spain. Sarah had returned with a very large purple toy donkey, which, while definitely Spanish, did not come up to what Adam instinctively felt should be the tone.